Okay, so today we'll talk about the theory of quantum measurement, and I'll give you, now that we understand how to model, composite quantum systems, we can talk about the coupling between the system and the apparatus as a quantum mechanical process and explore how we can model a measurement in an ideal way, known as von Neumann's indirect measurement model. And that allows us to do a measurement just on the apparatus system and induce a state update rule on the system of interest, which is this collapse of the wave function. So I hope this will add a lot of clarity about how measurement works in quantum mechanics. So let me just grab my notes here. So consider a system which we'll call HS. There's a Hilbert space and an apparatus which we'll call so this is some d-dimensional Hilbert space, and this will also make a d-dimensional Hilbert space, H apparatus, HA. Oh, cool, yeah, okay. So our Hilbert space is HS tensor HA. And then we imagine we have some initial state for the system. Which we'll just do everything in the pure state picture. In fact, I'll just use a regular state vector. Psi. And a ready state of the apparatus. Which is great. Which we'll just call zero. Now we want to measure some observable A, which is equal to, we want to measure A, which is some linear operator on HS. So A will take as some spectral decomposition. And for simplicity, we'll assume that it's non-degenerate. So we want We know from the Born rule, we know that the probability of outcome I given input state psi is equal to the trace of AI psi psi, which is just equal to psi AI squared. And the update rule tells us that the input state, so it says given outcome I naught is observed, Then we want the input state psi to become the state ai naught. And this happens with this probability. And then if the outcome is not observed, then we want, then psi is supposed to go to the mixed state . So let's see how this happens. So the model, okay, so that's kind of what we're trying to explain. Okay, so now our model is going to be that we are going to build everything based off of the fact that the eigenstates of the observable are what we care about. Okay, because we're trying to measure this operator A, we care about these eigenstates and the probabilities of getting them and the update rules in terms of that. So let's start by expand psi in this basis. In basis of A. So then we have psi is equal to a sum over I ci ai, where ci is equal to the inner product of psi with ai. So we can always do that. And then the way we build our apparatus, so we're going to build an apparatus, build apparatus to measure A. By constructing a unitary interaction, and the unitary is not fully constrained, but partially constrained. It's constrained by the fact that this unitary should take as input any state ai tensor 0. This is a system Hilbert space. And it should produce as output ai tensor I. So here we're only defining the action of u on a subset of all the states. So it's not fully specified. But this is sufficient for our purposes. So we construct a U such that, and what this is doing is it's inducing a correlation. So let me just say, what this does is induces a correlation, actually also an entanglement, it's a one-to-one between the system states, between the eigenstates of A and some orthonormal basis of H, what I call it, HA for the apparatus. It's slightly confusing, but H little a is the apparatus Hilbert space of HA. Okay, so of course, here, I'm assuming that this I here denotes is some orthonormal basis for HA. I think I just wrote that. We could write it this way if we wanted. Okay, so what does this look like? What this looks like is we have, so here time flows this way. We have our apparatus system, and we have our system. And then we imagine this unitary that we've just constructed couples them. And then we get some output state. On the system Hilbert space. You say 4. And then we have an output state for the apparatus Hilbert space. So now what we're going to do is we're going to measure HA. And in particular, we're going to measure the measurement is a projector valued measurement, which is equal to the set of projectors I. So we're not measuring the system. We've pushed the measurement, I mean, you can think of this as sweeping it under the rug, but we've pushed the measurement onto the apparatus system. So okay, so this is a generalization or instance or realization. I'm not sure which. It's related to what von Neumann proposed as an in of von Neumann's model of measurement. And this was done in the 1930s. So we call this, we'll call this the von Neumann indirect measurement method. Or model. Now here's the cool part. We can calculate this probability, right? So now what's the probability of outcome I on system A? Well, it's called probability of I naught given input state psi tensor 0. Where the input state now is, so here I'm assuming this is the input state. Why is that the input state when clearly the state has changed at this point? Because I'm imagining my measurement box. My measurement box here, the input state to the measurement box is psi. And then inside the box, there's some state 0 hanging around in HA. And then what happens inside the box is that you have, so this is inside the box. And then you have your measurement here. And then this has some wire that connects to your readout, and also some light. So, you know, the system, the ancilla system, which is your apparatus system, goes into this measurement, and we can imagine that measurement being a lot of different things. And the electronics, it induces a current based on the outcome, and that current causes the light to go off and causes the pointer to point to, this is I equals 1, all the way up to I equals D. Is that what I specified? Yeah, D. So we have D outcomes, I equals 1 to D, and the pointer is going to pick out one of those outcomes. Or 0 to D minus 1. And then the system state just continues on. So psi goes in, and some output state rho comes out. And so you see that the system itself has never been measured, really. It's actually just interacted with some other system, and that other system gets this violent measurement associated with, you know, the Born rule or whatever you want to call it. So from the point of view of outside the box, you would write the probability of I naught given input psi. But if you're inside the box, you would write, this is what you're doing. So this is outside box. And this is inside the box. So outside the box, we know we're supposed to get, the output is supposed to be the inner product of psi with AI squared. And inside the box, we can now calculate what it is. It's going to be, we're going to trace out the system. And now our measurement is do nothing on the system, do a projective measurement, II, onto the apparatus. And then you take as input state You take as input state this unitary, which acts on psi psi tensor 0, 0, u dagger. Okay, so what does that mean? What does that mean? The input state is psi tensor 0. The unitary happens. So here's our input state. This goes into the box. This is already inside the box. The unitary is part of the action of what happens inside the box. So we have UU dagger as the usual Schrodinger evolution that entangles the two systems. Then we perform a measurement where you do nothing on the system and you perform a measurement on the apparatus. And now we can compute this. This is a probability. So we just calculate this. And what's that going to be equal to? It's going to be, it's a partial trace over the system. So we sum over an eigenbasis of the system. And we put this whole argument inside of it. And then we can compute that, which I'll do now. So here the trace over S, well, I won't write it that way. I'll just write the probability of outcome I given psi tensor 0 is equal to a sum over AI identity S tensor II U psi tensor 0, 0, U dagger, AI. So now we know what U is. So recall, U is equal to a map that takes L tensor 0 to L tensor, did I call it L there? It takes AI tensor 0 to AI tensor I. So we're going, and we also have our expansion for psi. So we insert all this stuff. There's going to be thousands of sums. There's going to be lots of sums and lots of indices to keep track of. Let's just go through it painstakingly. Actually, all we need to compute is one side of it. We only need to compute AI. I, now this I is on system A. AI is on the system. So this is
Okay, and then we're going to have U acting on each input state. So U psi is equal to U acting on a sum over I CI AI, U acting on psi zero. So U acting on psi zero is going to give us, we know it's action on each of these guys, so we can compute this, and we get sum over I CI AI tensor I. Okay, and the sum here is just a dummy index, so we can just write this as sum over L CL AL tensor L. So that's this piece. And then similarly, U dagger is going to act on this this linear functional and this linear functional, and it's going to produce the conjugate. So we have U dagger acting on 0 psi is equal to, if we just call this state phi, then U dagger is going to equal phi. So that means that this is equal to sum over I AI identity on S tensor II, and then we'll call this phi AI. Am I missing a term somewhere? I think we're okay. All right, so now we have this is equal to a sum over I of, so this is going to pass through here, that's in the other Hilbert space, is equal to identity tensor II. AII phi AI. So if we introduce this phi as a sum over K CK bar, which is complex conjugate, AK K, and this is going to introduce a delta function, delta IK. This term here, we're going to pick out let me make sure I have this right here. Here I'm summing over a basis. I see what's wrong. So here's my measurement index. So I refers to an instance of the index. This is going to be some instance of the index. This sum that I introduced can't share the same index as this, right? Because it's a different index. So what I need to do is I need this sum. Let me just change this index to I naught. Okay, now here, let me just erase this for now. So here this sum this introduced the state phi, and we defined that sum to be L. And then on the other side, we had phi on this side from the U dagger, and that gave us the index K. So here, this is I naught, I naught. So what this is going to do is introduce a correlation between I and I naught, because that's the only term in this sum that will survive. Okay, let me just pause here and let you guys catch up and make sure that you're happy with the steps so far. Everybody good? Okay. Sorry, I've taken some notes this morning, but I can't find them. Yeah. So this piece, yeah, so U operating on psi tensor zero, so okay. Right, psi tensor zero, we know its action, it's going to be to induce this correlation, create an entangled state, which is a correlation between the system, the eigenstates of the observable of interest, and some ancilla states.
So this is phi is a state of the two of the interaction, not just the...
So actually, yeah, that's a good question. Let me just label the figure. So phi is the state right here at this point in time. So this does the kind of the hard work, and then we're just going to measure the ancilla, which is correlated with the system. And all we're going to get is a bunch of Kronecker delta functions that are going to give us a very simple answer, but I'm just trying to do all the bookkeeping on the fly. Just a second, go ahead.
Do you mean for the conditional probability of the thing we're looking for to also show up as an index?
As an index? This isn't an index. Oh, the probability I. Yeah, so right, so this should not be, in fact, this should be I naught. Great question. So this is the probability of getting outcome I naught, where I naught is some particular projector of your projective measurement. And then I is my dummy index for the trace. Yeah, so here, probability of I naught. So this needs to be a zero here as well. I naught there. And this should be I naught as well. So I naught is the outcome we're going to get. And I is dummy index. Yeah?
I don't understand how that probability is a trace over the system. It should be the trace over everything, this probability here.
Here.
If you're tracing over the system, The right-hand side is going to be a density matrix, not a number. I think this makes sense.
Okay, that's a good point. So, yeah, that's right. That's right. So here we actually want, we actually want a full trace, don't we? Yeah, the rewrite. We want the full trace here. That's correct. And so here we actually want to induce a measurement also over there's two steps we're gonna do. One step is we wanna calculate, we're gonna wanna do two things. We're gonna wanna calculate what is the state here, and we also wanna calculate the probability of this outcome. So I was kind of mixing the two up. So what we wanna do here is just calculate the probability of this outcome, which means it's a full trace. So this is a full trace. And then what we're doing here is we're summing then, the full trace means you sum over a basis for the apparatus as well. And that means let's call that J. So now we have a J here. And a J here. This is a sum over ij. And this is also going to be ai tensor j. And then we need to fix this as well. So here right away we see that this j is immediately going to hit this I, which is actually I naught. And so that's going to give us a delta function, delta j I naught. OK, so let me just redo this step going to here. So we're summing over I and j. J hits this guy here and gives us delta j I naught. This I and j are going to hit phi. Phi has a correlation. This is phi, the dual vector phi. The dual vector phi is written down here. So it has the index k. So this introduces a delta function delta I k, but k is also correlated here. So here we're going to get, once I write it in, we're going to get a correlation. We're going to get delta k j. From the fact that we have a J kicking around here, and it's going to hit so this phi is going to be take an inner product between phi I and J. This is phi, so the first term gives us a delta product, a delta function ki. The second factor gives us a Kronecker delta kj. And then this term gives us a Kronecker delta, and I'm missing an I somewhere. I'll fix that in a second. I naught. So basically, I, j, k are all going to collapse to I naught. It's the only value that can survive. Basically, this projector is going to pick out just the I naught term. Okay, so that means that basically we have to have I equals j equals k equals I naught. So now let me find my trailing factor. I'm missing a factor of I naught here. So we have, I'm missing a factor of I. So we have aj, that goes away. The ai carries through. We have phi ai, that's taken care of here. I think this piece is gone now, is the point. This is on the system and the apparatus. This is system apparatus. And then I have to keep track of my coefficients. So I had a CK bar, and I had a C, this expansion was L, I had a CL. So and then we had a sum over IJ, and then later on we had a sum over K and L from inserting these guys. I'm inserting this for this phi here. And so the final result we get then is just C I naught squared. okay, which is what we expected, which is this is equal to ci naught squared. So Born's rule tells us if we don't think about what's happening inside the box, we should get ci naught squared. If we look at what's happening inside the box, it becomes more complicated, but really it's just trivially more complicated because we get a bunch of Kronecker deltas that make only one term survive. So look, this was a little bit long-winded, and there's probably a much more compact way to show it, but I just wanted to explicitly write everything out and show how basically this projector means that the only terms that's going to survive in all of these sums are terms which are equal to I naught. Okay, so now we see that this von Neumann indirect measurement model has correctly produced the pointer. The pointer points to the output with the correct probability. So if the input state psi is an eigenstate of A, then there's only one term in this sum. And therefore, the only thing you get is probability one of the output being exactly whatever input state you put in. So this faithfully reports outcome certainty of getting, if the input state is I equals 3, so if psi is equal to I equals 3, then the probability of outcome I equals 3 is equal to 1. But if I is a superposition of several values, if psi is a superposition of several eigenstates of the observable, then we get different probabilities, the correct probabilities for each of those outputs. So this is a very complicated way to reproduce the Born rule, but here's the beauty of it. The beauty of it is that now we can just deduce. We can just deduce via the partial trace what the output state is, whether we condition on knowing what the pointer position was or not. So that way we get the collapse of the wave function for free via von Neumann's indirect measurement model. In fact, this is a variation of what von Neumann originally showed in the 1930s to prove that you had to have a state update rule, which is a state up Luder's rule. Well, he didn't. Luder's rule is more general, as we discussed. But the idea of it, of this non-deterministic collapse, was obtained by this kind of analysis, by inducing a correlation between a system and an apparatus, and then deducing what the state had to be after the measurement by a consistency argument. So now the point is, what is the output state? Well, the output state, it can be anything. Why can it be anything? For example, if what's happening inside my apparatus is this, a lead block here, okay, then the output is the null state. Well, it's not the, what's the null state? So there's no output. No output, but the but the Born rule is correct. Born rule is correct. So the Born rule is correctly reproduced, but there's no output state because I put a lead block. This was like the original way I drew the measurement apparatus without an output. But now if we design the system to have an output, then what can the output be? So let's do this as a lead block. Now, what else? What else could it be? Well, we could do this. We could design an apparatus. You order this online. measures the Born rule for some operator A. This is an A measurement from Acme Electronics. You have your zero state. You take your input. It does the unitary here. It does the measurement. You get the correct readout. Don't forget the light bulb. And then what they did then is they said, oh, well, we just happened to design it so there's some unitary here, where V is a unitary operator of d-dimensional unitary operator. V is an element of UD, which is the unitary operators on a d-dimensional system, for the system. So then the output, so this correctly reproduces the Born rule. But the output, so given pointer position I, I naught is going to be, and I haven't proven this yet, but you'll see how it follows immediately. The pointer position is going to be input psi goes to V I naught, which can be anything. So the fact that it reproduces the Born rule promises you nothing about the output state. So implicitly, when we talk about the update rule, we implicitly make the assumption that the measurement is repeatable. Okay, so repeatability is an implicit assumption to justify the von Neumann update rule. Okay, because here now what we want to see is we want to have we want the following setup. You buy two boxes from Acme Electronics, two A measurement boxes. Your input state psi goes in there. You get a pointer. The pointer gives readout I naught. And then you want to put another copy of the box, or you can just loop the output back into the input. Either way is fine. Then you want to require repeatability means that I prime for the second measurement is equal to I naught. So I prime is the readout here. So if it doesn't reproduce this, then you have no promise about the output state. But now if it does reproduce the output with probability 1, so if it produces output I naught again when you had output I naught here, and that happens, you do it enough times that you're confident that it's always true, then you can deduce, well, then if it's always, then the input state had to be I naught. So psi out must be equal to I naught, because I can do this for various I naught values, and I always get the same I naught value, whether it's 3 or 17 or 42, you always get the repeated outcome. So that means that the output had to be I naught. But now I can show you that if we drop this V, so if V is equal to identity, if V is equal to the identity operator, then we can deduce the output state. Okay, and that's simple. What we want to do is we want to say that rho out is equal to the partial trace over the apparatus of the state right here, which is phi. Okay, we already know what phi is. It's on so this is phi. So we do the partial trace. Let's see. So phi here is called L, phi there is called K. So let's do a sum over J. J. And then we have sum over L, CL, AL, L. And then sum over K, CK bar, AK, tensor K. And then we put another J here. And then you can see right away that the only term that's going to survive, oh, sorry, we decided that, this is going to be the output state. Okay, so then the output state is this. It's the sum over what index do we like the best? We'll call it L, CL squared, AL, AL. So the output state is a mixture of all the possible input states. So here we haven't conditioned on the observed output yet. So without conditioning, on the observed output, rho out is equal to sum over L CL squared ALL for input psi equal to sum over L CLL. So what's the difference between this state and that state? You should all know this. Maybe you're just too embarrassed to say it. It's so obvious.
It's the same state.
No, it's not. Expand it out. Let's look at, consider the state sigma equal to psi psi. Let's expand it out. We get a sum over L CL AL times a sum over K CK AK. This is an A. And then we're going to get a sum over L CL squared AL AL plus a whole bunch of cross terms, which represent the coherences. Sum over LK, sum over L not equal to K, CL, CK bar. So this piece here, these are the coherences. This is what makes the state quantum mechanical. These off-diagonal elements in the density matrix picture. So you started out with a state that was a coherent superposition of the different, sorry, I replaced, this is supposed to be AL. You start out with a coherent superposition of several possibilities. You put it through the measurement apparatus without looking at the output. We can deduce what the output state has to be by just tracing out the apparatus. And we get this mixed state. This is a mixed state. So it's not a pure state. And this is a pure state. So according to Schrodinger evolution, According to Schrodinger evolution, this is the output state. But according to the update rule, where we condition on the readout, the output state is, let me just write that over here. So by Schrodinger evolution, rho out is equal to the partial trace over the apparatus of phi phi, which is equal to a sum over L CL squared AL AL, which is a mixed state. But repeatability and conditioning on the observed output I naught says that rho out is equal to I naught, I naught, which is a pure state. And so this is how the, this is called the collapse of the wave function. And this is why this is inconsistent with Schrodinger evolution. Okay. So this is the original paradox that created all the fuss. So let me take time for some questions before I go on to my next point. Let me just say that this is decoherence. Decoherence of system due to coupling interaction with the apparatus. So this is known as measurement-induced decoherence. And that happens only if you don't look at the output. So if the pointer is broken on your device, so what do I mean by the pointer being broken? I mean, the unitary part works. Suppose that this device works as promised, but that these wires are cut. So the wires are cut. So, or maybe more importantly, either most importantly, this wire is cut. It doesn't really matter if the other wire is cut or not. If you assume this unitary happened, or if you know it happened because this light went off, then you know that your output state, you know that your output state has to be this, because you don't know what the measurement outcome was, because the pointer didn't reveal it to you, or because you didn't look at the pointer. This is your state of knowledge. This is equal to your state of knowledge without knowing or being, while when ignorant of the pointer position, which is the outcome of the measurement on A. On not system A, on the apparatus. The apparatus ancilla system. And this is your state of knowledge when you do know the pointer output, assuming repeatability.
State of knowledge if you do know one, the output I naught, and two,
and you also know that it's a repeatable measurement. By repeatable, I mean faithfully repeatable, not just the mere fact that you can repeat it, but that it repeatably gives you the correct answer. So if it's repeatable and you know the output, then you know this had to be the output state because it's the only state that can produce the empirical fact of repeatability. And this is the state without knowledge. And this is what you get from Schrodinger evolution, and this is what you get from the update rule. Questions? Obvious, not obvious, interesting, not interesting. Okay, no questions at this juncture? Yes?
Can you explain just one more time how this U mixes the system and the apparatus? Like, maybe some physical example of what?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. So, the physical example, and Maite showed me the examples you guys did. You guys did for your tutorial yesterday. So let me just use the Stern-Gerlach example. Okay, so a Stern-Gerlach example . What are these quantities in the Stern-Gerlach example? So here we have some oven and it produces a collimator. So some spin, some electron comes out. Maybe the oven produces electrons, and they have spin half. And we don't know, this is an oven, so it's probably going to produce a mixed state. So we'll fix that in a second. So then what you do is you have the system go into one of these Stern-Gerlach magnets, north and south, and then this induces a force on the trajectory of the electron based on its spin direction. So then you go up here or down here. So these are all going to be spin up, and these are all going to be spin down. That's not enough yet. Now, we want to do a measurement, right? So the measurement is going to be, let's assume that we can bend the trajectories using magnetic fields. So allow me to bend the trajectories without interrupting the spin. Then what you do is you put a wire detector chamber here. Okay, so a wire detector chamber is something, this is what I built for my master's degree when I did this high energy physics experiment. So basically what I helped build, and by helped build I mean polished the aluminum for a good vacuum seal. So there was no big creative contribution here. But what the point is, the way this works is, if let's assume what happens is you have some gas inside of a sealed chamber, and usually put a very thin piece of like aluminum foil on each end, and then actually it's trapped between two plates, and then you fill it with some kind of gas, xenon. We had xenon methane 90-10 mixture, and then what happens is when the electron passes through. So the purpose of our chamber was to distinguish electrons from pions, but a regular chamber, you would just have some gas in there. The electron ionizes the gas as it passes through the chamber. And then what that does is that ionized gas, these wires, have some kind of potential across them. So when the electron passes through, it ionizes the gas. All the little baby electrons that come off of the gas, not the original electron, which is traveling fast, say, all the baby electrons are created with some very low energy from the ionization. They get collected to the wires and get pulled to the positive voltage source, which then induces a current in the wire. So this is ground. Okay, and we're going to do the same thing down here. And you have some gas in here. Now, normally what you can do is you can do the crisscross pattern of the wires and you can get a very precise readout of the electron's position. But for our purposes, we don't care about that. We just want to know, did this wire chamber see a current or did this wire chamber see a current? We'll do this plus minus, and this is attached to ground. And then this connects to your apparatus. So now we have two different wires, and then what happens is we then have a pointer which can have one of two positions. This is spin up, and this is spin down. This is our pointer. Okay, and so if the current comes in this wire, the pointer points to the left. If the current's in this wire, the pointer points to the right. That way, and then the electron, of course, passes through. We recombine the beams, and then this is our output. Okay, so actually what we've done here is, forget the oven, let's just now put this as an input state. So forget about the oven, that was not important. We have some input state that goes in where psi is in C2, so it's the two-level system of the electron. Now what have I neglected in this simple picture? Here I'm fishing for something, so it's gonna be difficult for you guys. Maybe I shouldn't leave you in suspense. What I'm neglecting is the electron's position. Okay, because here I'm talking about whether the electron goes up or down. So really what's happening is I have my HS is equal to C2, and then the degree of freedom I'm exploiting to do the measurement is the position of the electron. So let's call this X and Z. So then we have another Hilbert space, which is L2R, which is our apparatus Hilbert space. And this is the, and here we have psi of x is an element of L2R. And then we say this path we'll call psi plus of x, and this path we'll call psi minus of x. So now at this stage, right here, we've created the state phi. So here we have the state phi in the general abstract theory corresponds to a superposition over plus versus minus. Well, let me not do that that way. Let me just write the superposition. We have some probability C plus of the spin being up and in the state psi plus, plus the, not the probability, the amplitude, of course, plus the amplitude of the spin being down correlated with the down eigenstate, which is a spatial eigenstate. Okay, and then here, of course, we're assuming here that this is the input psi, so this is out. It's actually not out. It's at this stage here, phi. And here, psi in, the input state is C plus up plus C minus down. And now, of course, I'm neglecting the degree of freedom associated with Z, because it's not important for the analysis. And why aren't important? I mean, Z is what actually propagates me through. So if I wanted to include Z, I could also have phi tensor some other state, chi, where chi is in L2R. And this corresponds to here chi expressed in the Z basis is equal to e to the I kz, or what is it, minus maybe. This represents propagation through the device. Okay, so that's not important. What's important is that we created this correlation, this entanglement between the spin degree of freedom and the position, the x position. So psi plus, so here psi plus x is equal to x psi plus. So this is the representation of the abstract vector with respect to the space of square integral functions. And we know that this is actually a problem and we don't worry about that. But so this is our correlation. And now once you've created that correlation, you do all kinds of neat stuff. So one of the things you can do is you can measure it. And then you can know for certain what the spin of the output state is based on the outcome of the measurement. You can not look at the output. and then you're going to have a mixture. So if you look at the output, your output state's going to be either this or this, conditional on what output you got. If you don't look at the output, then you now we're tracing out the x-coordinate, because now we're not paying attention to the x degree of freedom anymore. We just have some plane wave coming out, and then we would get, without conditioning, we'd get the coherent mixture of these two, the incoherent mixture of these two, which is this state here. And what else can we do? I promised you a week ago that I would show you how a measurement is really a preparation device. I can replace one of these screen detectors with a lead block. I put a lead block here. The only thing that comes out is spin up. So now this has become a state preparation device. So this could be a measurement device, a state preparation device, depending on whether you put wire chambers here or if you put a lead block there. Okay? Thank you for that question. I'm glad I went through this. I think this clarified for a lot of people what's going on. And so the problem is often there's these implicit degrees of freedom that you kind of, if you don't keep track of them, it doesn't make sense. It's by keeping track of this composite Hilbert space and conditioning on it that you get the output we want. Other questions? Okay, so what I'd like to tell you last is something I mentioned earlier, and there were some questions about in the feedback, which is, what do I mean by the state update rule is classical? Well, what I mean by that is that I can build this device classically and talk about what's a large charged object. It doesn't have to be charged, I guess. Okay, forget charge. Let's just imagine some gyroscope. Okay, so a gyroscope is just some angular momentum vector pointing in some direction. This is a classical object. It's a spinning top. Okay, so now what I'm going to do is I'm going to take my spinning top, I'm going to put it through, say it's magnetic, okay, it's a magnet. So I put my spinning top, my gyroscope goes into here, and it's in some unknown state. So what does that mean? I describe the direction with what? A probability distribution, right? So I assign some probability density or probability dense distribution to the input, because I don't know what direction it's pointing. So I assign my state of knowledge, which is I don't know. And then I build a Stern-Gerlach magnet in here. What is that going to do? It's going to give a momentum boost to the rotating magnet, either to go up or down. And now I put my little detector here. It doesn't have to be an ion chamber anymore. This is classical, so we can just detect its passage in a million ways. We could just have some laser that detects if the laser gets interrupted, like the way the doors open at the grocery store because they see you coming, right? They just a little detection. You cross the beam gets interrupted, it opens the door. Okay, so then we can know whether the gyroscope went up or down, and that can give us a little pointer. This is gyroscope was up, and this is the gyroscope was down with respect to our x-axis. So we don't care about exactly what direction the gyroscope was pointing in. All we want to know is the angle of the is theta, what's that called, the azimuthal angle? Is that either in the top hemisphere or the bottom hemisphere with respect to x? That's all we want to know. That means there's going to be some range of deflections here based on the angle theta that the gyroscope's actual direction points relative to x up. And there's going to be some range of deflections here. And then I can recombine the gyroscope using magnetic fields again, and I get some output, and then I get some unknown gyroscope state coming out of my device. Now, if I use the laws of classical mechanics, and I say, what's the output state? Well, the output state is going to be the same mixture of the input states that it was originally. So the difference being that quantum mechanics, when we don't measure the output, kills off the coherence, but there's been no collapse. So all we're saying here is that quantum mechanics is different than classical mechanics because quantum mechanics has coherence. What's presented as a paradox isn't the fact that the superposition becomes a mixture. What's presented as a paradox is that only one outcome is obtained when you observe the output, which is this case here. But that we can explain classically, because if I observe the output, then I read out up or down. If I start out with a uniform probability measure, the gyroscope could be pointing in any direction in three-dimensional space. I put it through this device. Now I don't know what direction it's pointing in if I see up, but I know it's in the upper hemisphere. So my state, which started out as a uniform probability density on the sphere, after the measurement collapses to a probability density just on the upper half of the sphere. So this is where I observe up. And so this is a new state, rho out, which is just a hemisphere. A hemisphere of uncertainty. Okay, so we have this discontinuous deformation of a uniform probability measure, which is isotropic in space, to a probability measure which is now not, which is anisotropic. It's only on one half of the hemisphere. So this can't be described by classical mechanics, because under Hamiltonian mechanics, we have a symplectic flow on phase space, which is area preserving. This is not allowed within classical dynamics. Is that clear that this isn't allowed in classical dynamics?
Why is it not allowed?
Because Hamilton's laws of motion, which are our classical laws of motion, say that whenever I have a probability measure in phase space, if it evolves in time, the shape can change, but the area has to be conserved. So you can't just chop off half the probability distribution. It kills normalization, right? You lose normalization. And that's exactly what happens here. We have a uniform measure that's continuous on the sphere, and then it gets chopped off. But this isn't surprising. The reason it's not surprising is because we know classical mechanics is not supposed to describe that. What describes that is Bayes' rule. So this is just Bayes' rule. This is just Bayes' rule for updating probabilities based on new information. And when do you update your probabilities? When you get more information about the system. The pointer position gives you information about the system, therefore you update your probabilities, you get a discontinuous transformation, which is random. Whether you're going to ascribe the up state or the down state depends randomly on whether you saw up or down. So we see that the mystery of quantum mechanics isn't that we have a state update rule, it's the fact that we lose coherence, which is what's special about quantum mechanics. Was there a question? No? I hope that helped a bit. I mean, it takes a while to, once you're stuck in the habit of thinking of quantum states as physical objects, it becomes very difficult to think of them differently. But once you kind of practice enough, you can start thinking about it. Just always think about a quantum state as my probabilistic information describing a preparation procedure. And then if that explains what you're looking at, you're fine. If it doesn't explain what you're looking at, then you're seeing a true quantum effect. So this collapse business is actually just a failure to it's based on an unjustified assumption. The mystery of collapse that von Neumann and Dirac struggled with, and many of our colleagues still struggle with, is based on a false assumption that quantum states are physical. And if you drop that assumption, which is empirically unnecessary and not scientifically motivated, then you don't have that paradox. Yes?
Can you say again why quantum is weird then? Because this just seems to make sense. So I don't
Thank
see
you.
What the weird part is.
Well, that isn't the weird part. In fact, everything about a qubit can be described classically. The weirdness of quantum mechanics, what's special about quantum mechanics, what allows us to have quantum computers be more powerful than classical computers, what allows us to have superfluidity and superconductivity and all these really neat things about quantum mechanics is not actually this. What it is some intermingling of several properties simultaneously. And we have concrete evidence that those things are intermingling correctly when we see either a violation of Bell's theorem or a proof of contextuality, which is something we can touch on later. So things like contextuality and Bell's theorem cannot be explained by a classical mechanical model plus classical probability theory.
So basically, everything we've done so far is describing stuff that could be applied in classical mechanics with uncertainty
Correct.
In whatever we're measuring.
Yes.
So we haven't done anything that's like explicitly Quantum yet. Unique to...
Yeah. Well, mind you, I gave you the axioms, and those axioms can be applied to any dimensional quantum system in any scenario. So the point is, we haven't looked at cases where those axioms, when they're realized as concrete systems in particular Hilbert spaces with particular properties, we haven't looked at instances where we truly see distinguishing features of quantum mechanics. So that's something we'll do. I mean, that's something that's implicit in a lot of the stuff, but we can make it explicit by looking at Bell's theorem and contextuality. Then you see true quantum mechanical effects, and that's when you know you're kind of in business dealing with novel things that aren't describable by 19th century physics. Yeah?
Say if you have classical probability density, can you have off-diagonal terms? Like, can you have coherences?
So yes, there is a way to mock up coherences. So the way to mock up coherences is exactly this. I can describe, if I have a hemisphere pointing to the right versus a hemisphere of uncertainty on the left, I can think of this as a coherent superposition of up plus down, and I can think of this as a coherent superposition of up minus down. So we can simulate coherence through accessing other dimensions of the gyroscope. So here, this upper hemisphere is spin up, and the lower hemisphere is spin down. And then whether or not, so we can be in a state, so both of these states are a mixture of up and down, 50% probability up, 50% probability down. This one has 50% probability up, 50% probability down. But they have distinct features if we measure along the xy axis. And so what's distinctive about a coherent superposition of up and down quantum mechanically versus a mixture of up and down, right? So if we have a pure state of a two-level of a qubit, which is a coherent superposition of up and down with some phase, or we can have a mixture of up and down. In quantum mechanics, if I do a Z measurement, I can't tell the difference between these two. The way I tell the difference is by doing an X or a Y measurement, and then I'll get different probabilities of those outcomes. So for example, the quantum state up plus down, square root of 2, this is equal to the plus x eigenstate. So this is equal to spin up along x. So if I have this quantum state, I'm talking about quantum mechanics, and then I do an x measurement with my Stern-Gerlach device, I say, is the system pointing along x up or x down? I get 100% of the time that the spin is pointing up along the x-axis. If I have this quantum superposition of Z up and Z down, this is equal to down along, this is a SX down eigenstate. So if I do a Stern-Gerlach X measurement on this input state, then I always get the negative h bar over 2 eigenvalue for my X measurement 100% of the time. So that's coherence, right? Z, it's 50-50 probability of up or down along Z for each state, but the X measurement reveals totally different statistics. In fact, it's orthogonal. So they're perfectly distinguishable by an X measurement, and they're not distinguishable at all by a Z measurement. So that's the same thing here. Here, if I do a Z measurement and my probability is concentrated along this hemisphere or this hemisphere, I get 50% Z up, 50% Z down for either of these two states. But if this is the x-axis, and I do an X measurement on this classical gyroscope system where this corresponds to my lack of knowledge of where the gyroscope is, 100% of the time I get X up with this state, and 100% of the time I get X down, or minus h bar over 2, which is, or minus whatever the angular momentum is of the gyroscope, for this outcome. So you see that we can mock up. So this is the Cochin-Specker model called the KS model, based on this Cochin-Specker model from 1967. So I didn't make this up. This has been known for 50 years, that we can reproduce everything about a qubit with a classical gyroscope system if we interpret the quantum states as lack of knowledge about the underlying property, which is which way is the gyroscope pointing. So we can reproduce anything about a qubit, superposition, no cloning theorem, whatever. The BB84 QKD protocol, whatever you want. It's all there. But this model was presented, why did Cochin and Specker produce this model? Because they developed this proof of contextuality, and their proof only worked for dimensions 3 and greater. So basically they showed that there was something bizarre about quantum mechanics when the dimension was 3 or more. And they said, well, what is our proof just deficient and we can't prove it for d equals 2? And then they showed that they can never prove it for d equals 2 because d equals 2 had a perfect classical explanation. So qubits have a perfectly classical, one qubit has a perfectly classical explanation. It's only when you have a bigger system or more than one qubit in an entangled state and you do certain sets of measurements that you can't explain the results based on classical physics and classical probability theory anymore. And so I feel like it's such an obvious thing that it's been kind of frustrating to me that the majority of physicists just have no clue about it. And, you know, so I just, you know, it's kind of my life mission is to educate the next generation so you guys don't repeat the same mistakes of the previous generation and have more creative insights into what's truly quantum mechanical. I think that's important for the field to progress. So, yeah. All right, we should probably go get lunch. So thanks for the great questions today, and we'll see you after the weekend.